political tensions escalating in the U.S. Lawmakers of the Democratic Party are preparing a draft article of impeachment against President Trump. A new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus spreads to at least 8 U.S. states as the country registers a new record of daily infections. An Indonesian passenger plane with more than 60 people on board goes missing shortly after takeoff from Jakarta. And welcome. You've tuned into World News from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the first story takes us back to the United States this hour, where President Donald Trump has written the final chapter of his presidency by causing chaos in the already divided nation. The president has been accused of inciting his supporters to storm the Capitol. While Trump supporters remain a threat before the new president is inaugurated, calls for an immediate removal of Trump from office are getting louder. More in the following report.
With just over a week before the departure of Donald Trump from the White House, a public emergency has been declared in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. That after an unprecedented chaos and the violent storming of the Capitol building by Trump supporters in their efforts to force Congress to overturn the presidential election results. U.S. officials refer to these incidents as days of infamy, accusing Trump of directly inciting the mob to what they call shameful assaults on the American democracy. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the United States.
I've been saying for now well over a year, he is not fit to serve. He is not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
The president has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people. If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave Oval Office voluntarily. According to U.S. media, Democratic representatives have already prepared a draft article of impeachment that accuses Trump of engaging in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting the Capitol Hill insurrection. He will be the first American president to be impeached twice by the House. Democrats are not alone in their bid. Some Republicans have also joined their rallying cries against Trump.
The president is unfit, and the president is unwell. And the president must now relinquish control of the executive branch voluntarily or involuntarily.
A recent joint Reuters-Ipsos opinion poll also shows 57% of Americans are in favor of Trump's immediate removal from office. 7 out of 10 of those who had voted for Trump in the November election also decried the recent storming of the Capitol building. Surprisingly, defiant Trump later denounced the violent protests and pledged for a peaceful transition of power. However, hours later, he once again took to his Twitter saying he would not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. Twitter has now permanently suspended his account, saying several of Trump's posts violate the platform's policy against the glorification of violence. Trump says Twitter is banning free speech. With a traditional departure of a sitting president from Washington now off the table, security concerns are growing for Biden's inauguration. Photos and videos emerging from the Capitol seat show the extent of violence American rioters and white supremacists are capable of. Deaths and vandalism at the Capitol show the United States' much-touted slogan of democracy can be easily endangered by its very own citizens.
China has introduced new rules to counter what it calls unjustified foreign laws and pressure targeting Chinese interests. The Commerce Ministry said the rules also aim to protect the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese people and companies. It said persons or firms may report to authorities within 30 days if they face restrictions or prevention from foreign laws. The ministry added that the government may also take reciprocal steps against those laws. Well, the move comes as many Chinese firms are under intense foreign pressure, particularly from the United States. Washington has already blocked several Chinese social media apps and has placed restrictions on telecom giant Huawei, citing security reasons. That's amid a trade war between the world's top two economies since the arrival of Donald Trump to the White House. Well, the new mutated strain of the coronavirus has spread to at least 8 U.S. states amid America's uphill battle with the pandemic. Connecticut became the 8th state to announce detecting the new strain, which was first found in Britain late last year. Officials reported a total of 63 cases of the new viral variant, with California and Florida being the worst affected. This is while the U.S. set a new record for daily infections on Saturday, registering 290,000 cases. Also, 3,600 COVID-19-related deaths were reported, pushing the overall deaths to 370,000. The U.S. is the hardest-hit nation in the world, with nearly 22 million infection cases. The passenger plane that went missing shortly after takeoff from the Indonesian capital is feared to have crashed.
We received information from local residents that they found some debris, and the debris was sent to Langkang Island, the island near where the flight lost contact. We still don't know what it is, but the debris is currently on the search and rescue agency boat that is at the scene at the moment. Later, it will be identified by National Transportation Safety Committee.
An emergency center has been set up at the Jakarta International Airport. The Indonesian Transport Minister says the airliner deviated from its heading before losing contact. Buddha Kaya Samadi added that the 26-year-old Boeing 737-500 was in good condition, but the flight was delayed for 30 minutes due to heavy rain. 62 crew and passengers, including 10 children, were on board the plane, which was en route to the city of Pontianak. The Navy says the coordinates of the aircraft have been determined and ships deployed to the location. Indonesia has been docked by aviation disasters. In 2018, a Boeing 737 MAX crashed about 12 minutes after takeoff from Jakarta, killing all 189 passengers and crew. And now it's time for this hour's news review. Thousands of people in the Pakistani city of Quetta have gathered to bury 11 miners killed in a Daesh attack. Mourners paid their last respects to the victims of the terrorist attack, which shocked the country last Sunday. Daesh terrorists brutally killed the miners in a residential compound near a coal mine. All victims were members of the Shia Hazara community. Now, the incident prompted massive protests across Pakistan. Demonstrators have slammed the killing as systematic ethnic cleansing of Hazaras in Balochistan. They blame security forces for doing nothing to protect them. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review out of Islamabad, Javed Rana, and out of London from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem. Thank you both for being with us. Starting it off in Javed. Well, Javed, let's talk about the incident itself and what we know, and since that time, as far as investigation and demands by members of the community for the government to get involved and do something.
Well, the government claims that most of the demands of the protesters have been accepted, but obviously one of the key demands that the killer must be punished, that is not there, in the sense that it has not been the government has not been able to crack down those terrorists who were involved in this heinous crime. Now there is a bigger picture, and bigger picture goes much beyond the internal political dynamics in Pakistan. The opposition parties tried to politicize this issue, and there was a debate on whether or not Prime Minister should visit these grieved families while they have yet to bury their loved ones. Now, there is a bigger picture which Prime Minister has finally explained to the media today. And he said that in March this year, he had received reports from intelligence agencies that such terrorist attacks are underway, and India is going to be behind those terrorist attacks. And the very objective and the motive behind those terrorist attacks, according to intelligence reports, would be to foment sectarian violence in Pakistan. And that is a bigger picture, and I think this is where the Prime Minister is trying to focus on. And he told the grieving families that the government would punish those terrorists, but certainly it needs more time to find them out. Where are they? Unfortunately, there is a porous border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and there has been back and forth movement of these terrorists. These terrorists have got shelter inside Afghanistan. That is what the government of Pakistan has been saying since long, and they have repeated their allegations. But again, among the 11, 7 were the Afghan citizens. And the government on one side was under pressure from the Afghan government to hand back the dead bodies. On the other hand, Prime Minister was under pressure from the opposition parties and the grieving family members that he must visit before the burial. So these are the small issues. Bigger issues are that unfortunately in Pakistan, particularly in the Balochistan province, it has been the hotbed of insurgency, and it is a well-known fact that India has been sponsoring this insurgency. India needs violence in that part of Pakistan, whether that violence comes through sectarian nature or it is that there is a Baloch tribal separate insurgency. And then unfortunately also, the Israel has been very active behind the scene. It operates secretly in that part of Pakistan, and it has been trying to use allegedly these terrorist groups like Daesh to foment sectarian violence in Pakistan at a time when Pakistan has been under pressure from the Arab allies, and which means that in fact from the Israel to recognize it.
All right, so, well, let me cross over to London. Reza, your take, you heard what Javed talked about, the possible Indian involvement, but in general, your assessment of the situation. And we have been seeing this type of violence against the Hazara community for years now. Of course, here in the report, it says that Daesh was behind it. Who profits from this type of violence? Because we always look at who benefits and who loses in any situation. Your take.
I think there are a number of factors here, and I'm a bit surprised by some of the analysis that's actually been provided thus far and the lack of kind of pointing out to some of the local developments that have actually taken place within the Pakistani context, in particular the issue of Sipah Sahaba and how they have been a number of 40 or 50 members have been identified as ex-Sipah Sahaba who are now in Ahl Sunnat wal Jamaat, who are now in parliament, who are the allies of Imran Khan and so on and so forth. And it's quite interesting that when someone is in power and when they're not in power, how they're responding to this situation. If you look back at the video clips of Imran Khan from 2013, you can see very clearly that he was quite condemning of the fact that the Prime Minister at the time was not visiting Quetta when an incident not too different from this actually took place at that time. And now he is calling the very people who've been killed and whose people are demanding that he comes and visits them, that they are blackmailers and so on. So it's quite a disappointing turn that when someone has come to power, he has taken this attitude towards the people who've been murdered. In terms of the actual situation in that part of Balochistan, let's not confuse insurgencies. This is not about an insurgency. This is about what the security establishment of Pakistan actually wants to have within the remit of allowing certain people and certain players to have a free role. And in that free role, what they will do is have that sectarian element also being put out, which is to carry out these killings and on a sectarian basis. So this is something that needs to be understood in terms of how people are actually operating. Pakistan claims to be one of the greatest security services, one of the greatest powers, as it were, in that region to be able to control things and so on, and yet it has not been able to provide protection for that particular community in that area for any number of years, going back, regardless of governments and so on and so forth, going back decades and so on, and this has not been done, despite them being an open target and so on. So
why is that the case, Reza? Let me just jump in here. And why do you think that is the case, that this particular community have not been protected by various governments we have seen to come and go in Pakistan?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we need to understand that the security establishment, the Pakistani army, is playing a game within there. Rather than providing that security and so on, some analysts have actually talked about the fact that they are, while they're taking on the insurgency with regards to the issue of Balochistan and the nationalism that is generated there, they are using these takfiri elements, what's been called as Daesh or IS claiming responsibility, but actually they're very much embedded within the local scene within Pakistan, and they're Pakistanis who are carrying out this atrocity, who have carried out this, these kinds of atrocities in the past and so on, and the Pakistani government is not prepared to pick up on them. And I think the question also arises that when you have someone in power who actually claimed that the Prime Minister at the time should have come out and doesn't come out now, is clearly working on what the security establishment is telling him to do, when to do it, how to do it, rather than taking the principled stance that he should be taking what he called for when he was not in power. And I think that is problematic, because there doesn't seem to be... He talked about bringing a change in terms of what was going to be happening in Pakistan. And people were looking for that change. One of the conditions that these people put on there with regards to this was to say, let's have Imran Khan come here before we bury the dead. And then in the end, they were just dejected in terms of the idea that he would have called them blackmailers and so on and so forth, and used this kind of language against the people who were suffering at this point in time. When you have examples like the New Zealand Prime Minister going out to visit members of that community in that open way, you know, he needs to understand that he has lost a lot of will, and I think the parties that are standing with him need to think about their alliances with him, because that is also very problematic. One thing I would say, and I would really commend the Pakistani society and the Pakistani people on, is the way that people from across the country, ordinary people from across the country, have joined the protest from spectrum of the Muslim community, not just one section of the Muslim community, but from different sections of the Muslim community. I think, and in that, we have hope that this can this unity will try to bring, will put a marker out there that this is something that is not acceptable, and people in power really need to take heed of this.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with us. Sorry, we're out of time. Thank you both. Javed Rana out of Islamabad and Reza Kazem, Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Africa Today.
The year 2020 was a year like no other for people the world over, including Africa. It was a tumultuous year due to the deadly COVID-19 pandemic. Nigeria was the first country in sub-Saharan Africa to confirm a case of the novel coronavirus. This is how the country's health minister made the announcement.
The Ministry of Health has confirmed a coronavirus disease case in Lagos, Nigeria, known as COVD. Okay. COVID-19.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which will be highlighting on some of the major events that shook Africa in 2020. Apart from the COVID-19 pandemic, other events that made headlines in Africa include protests against police brutality in Nigeria, the military coup in Mali, the U.S. forcing some African countries to establish ties with the Israeli regime, and the crisis in Ethiopia. So join me till the end for an insight on some of the events that made headlines in Africa last year.
Africa Review in 2020. Impact of COVID-19 in Africa.
We shall start off our program with the COVID-19 pandemic. As the year ended, there were over 2.5 million confirmed COVID-19 cases on the African continent, with more than 2.1 million recoveries and 60,000 deaths cumulatively.
According to the World Health Organization, COVID-19 transmission in Africa has been marked by relatively fewer infections, which have been on the decline owing to a variety of socio-ecological factors, as well as early and strong public health measures taken by governments across the region.
Most African countries are relying on the multilateral COVAX facility, which is unlikely to distribute vaccines as quickly compared to those countries that have made advanced purchases from manufacturers. The World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom, has expressed concern that poor countries might not get the vaccine.
The urgency with which vaccines have been developed must be matched by the same urgency to distribute them fairly. Every government rightly wants to do everything it can to protect its people. But there is now a real risk that the poorest and most vulnerable people will be trampled in the stampede for vaccines.
Now, while reports of a vaccine brought hope for an end of the COVID-19 pandemic, the emergence of a new variant of the new coronavirus in South Africa and Nigeria dampened expectations of recovery from the pandemic in the immediate future. South African Minister of Health, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, explains here on how they plan to handle the new variant of COVID-19.
This situation can be handled in the way that COVID-19 has been handled, even though it might be a variant. But it's actually important that you can handle it because the approaches are still the same as what we've been using dealing with COVID-19 as it has been brought to our attention. Many countries have experienced a second wave that was more severe than the first wave. So we're not different now to other countries. Many countries have gone through what we've gone through. Even in countries who have not themselves reported any mutations, we've seen that there's been an increase. So in our case, we're also seeing that there might be the pattern, so we must gear up for a stronger fight against COVID-19.
Every cloud has a silver lining. This has been the case with Africa, as the COVID-19 pandemic provided a springboard for innovations across the continent. According to the WHO analysis, 57.8% of health technologies and innovations in Africa were driven by information and communications technology, 25% were based on 3D printing, and 10.9% were robotics.
We talked to Dr. Roderick Chibi, who is the World Health Organization Regional Advisor for Innovation in Africa, and this is what he had to say.
You realize that countries relied on the already existing platforms. For instance, due to high mobile penetration in most of the African countries, there was an emergence of technologies or self-assessment and alert mobile applications that governments were able to deploy and mainstream in their COVID-19 response. You'll realize that population at large, for instance, in Niger, in South Africa, in Togo, population were able to screen themselves and also alert key stakeholders to manage if there are any symptoms that they needed to address. So we realized that where technological platforms were already in existence, it was easy to apply some frugal mind in terms of deploying some of those innovative approaches to countries. I can give you another example where we saw a drone technology which was deployed in Rwanda and Ghana.
That's the WHO Regional Director for Innovation in Africa, and stay tuned for more.
Ethiopia dam dispute and instability in Tigray region.
The regional dispute that dominated headlines in Africa in 2020 was the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, Since 2011, the Ethiopian government has pushed ahead with the construction of the dam on the Blue Nile.
The project, which is set to become Africa's largest hydroelectric power plant, is opposed by Egypt and Sudan over the concerns that the dam will affect their water security. While the African Union has been trying to resolve the dispute through talks, the interference by the United States has further heightened regional tensions. In a telephone conversation with Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, U.S. President Donald Trump said that Egypt will have to blow up the Ethiopian dam.
And it's a very dangerous situation because Egypt is not going to be able to live that way. And they'll end up blowing up the dam. And I said it, and I say it loud and clear, they'll blow up that dam.
In reaction, Ethiopia's foreign minister Gedu Andargachew said the remarks by Trump are unacceptable in international law governing interstate relations. Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt have conducted several meetings under the brokerage of the African Union over the last few months. But they reached a stalemate every round they held on the technical and legal points of contention.
Ashok Swain, a professor of peace and conflict research at the Department of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University, explains here on what are the stumbling blocks in reaching an agreement over the management of the Nile.
If most of these issues have been addressed, the real problem lies if there is a long-term drought period in the basin, because the climate change has made it also quite a problematic. That if there is, and that area region is also quite prone to have long-term drought seasons. So if that takes place, how to share or how Ethiopia will ensure that certain amount of water reaches Egypt?
Now, apart from the dam dispute, Ethiopia has been in the news due to several ethnic conflicts in the country, especially in the Tigray region. The conflict in one of Africa's most ethnically diverse populous countries is thought to have displaced close to 1 million people and killed thousands.
Late November, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed announced the end of military operations in the rest of region of Tigray after federal troops took control of the regional capital after a three-week-old war that has shaken the Horn of Africa. Abiy's government started the operation to quell a rebellion by Tigray People's Liberation Front, which was the ruling party in the Tigray regional government. Abiy said his government had every right to launch the military operation.
The federal government had every right to deploy federal security forces and use force in order to apprehend those implicated in massive corruption and gross human rights violations.
Forces of the Tigray People's Liberation Front are still engaging in armed hostilities against the federal government troops in parts of the rest of region. Over the last year, hundreds have also been killed in other parts of Ethiopia due to ethnic-related violence.
What needs to be done to stop possible Balkanization of Ethiopia and heal the gaping divisions across the country? This is the question we pose to Samuel Getachew, a journalist with the Reporter newspaper in Addis Ababa.
And there has to be an adult conversation that needs to go on among Ethiopians. Are we becoming an arrogant nation where a few would be in control and the rest will be abused like before? Or are we going to have the kind of hope the Prime Minister gave many Ethiopians at the beginning of his term, including the protection of human rights, press freedom, and even inviting the opposition to come back home and compete in an election, the role of the diaspora. All this was discussed openly by Abiy Ahmed, and it gave many people, including myself, hope. But now I think Ethiopia has tilted to the back. It's like it's going back to the old year, and that shouldn't be. If we want to peace and prosperous nation, it needs to change, and the change should begin immediately before we also start another conflict in other parts.
Well, we all look forward to sustainable peace and stability in Ethiopia.
The Mali coup.
Mali, a fragile West African country, was once again in the news for the wrong reasons. Thousands of Malians took to the streets for several months, calling on President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita to resign over corruption and economic mismanagement.
Today is the last day of presidency of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. Yes. And we are calling everybody to come out to support this popular riot.
A series of protests filling the streets of Mali's capital, Bamako, culminated in a military coup in August. Keita resigned after soldiers seized him from his home. He appeared on national television to announce his resignation.
How has the Mali crisis impacted on the wider Sahel region in Africa, especially considering the fact that regional terrorist groups operate in parts of the country?
Mali crisis there will definitely impact the rest of the countries, and this total instability in Mali, it means strength of these groups, if they become strong, who knows, if they won't even spread across to the five countries as well. If they were to do that, then there's a danger, there's a big danger of the future of the entire region and also Africa. It will take a long time to kind of dismantle that kind of order. So what's happening in Mali impacts the rest of the region in a very big way.
The coup leaders established the National Committee for the Salvation of the People to set up a new government. On September 12th, the rebels appointed former Defense Minister Ba Ndaw as transition president and formed the interim government set to roll for 18 months before the new elections are held. Africa Review in 2020. SARS protests and terrorism in Nigeria.
Over the past few months, Nigeria witnessed protests against a British-trained notorious police unit known as Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS. The protests have been Nigeria's most powerful over the recent years. Though the protesters don't have a leader, the demonstrators are mainly young people who say they've been unfairly profiled by SARS.
All of us are tired. We're tired of the killings, we're tired of the extortion, we're tired of the harassment, we're tired of people that are meant to protect us killing us. It just doesn't make any sense. They are raping us. We are tired of everything.
Now, what are the underlying factors behind the protests against police brutality in Nigeria? To get an answer, we contacted Julius Baluto, an African affairs analyst.
You had a huge chunk of youth who have been discouraged and feel suppressed by the regimes that every election has produced. You talk about all these former military men, the current president, Buhari, and also even some of other former presidents have had military background. Talk even about Obasanjo, former president of Nigeria. But they are wealthy, they are rich, they are old, and therefore for many, many years, a huge chunk of youth in Nigeria felt not really represented. And we're seeing a situation whereby the police and this court became the epitome of corruption and suppression and oppressing Nigerians.
Julius Mbaluto there, speaking of the reasons for recent protests in Nigeria. Stay tuned for more in our program today.
In 2020, Nigeria continued to witness deadly attacks carried out by the Boko Haram Takfiri terrorist group. Thousands were killed and many more injured. This terrorist group also kidnapped hundreds of people, including students. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, more than 30,000 people have been killed and nearly 3 million displaced in a decade of Boko Haram violence in Nigeria. Why has the Nigerian government failed to stop Boko Haram terrorism despite having one of the largest armies in Africa?
Now, first of all, how is Boko Haram still around? I mean, literally, Nigerians have had enough of them. We don't understand where this group came from. They do not represent any real Nigerians as far as we're concerned, whether they're Muslim or Christian. And also, how can any group like this be more powerful than their so-called Nigerian army with all of its resources? It's an absolute joke. We have have to be clear about the international, you know, support as well as domestic support that Boko Haram receives, where the average Nigerian is sick and tired and fed up of them, but they're not being supported in, you know, in the northern towns of, in the country to defeat them, to be honest. You know, we've seen a resurgence in Boko Haram, surprisingly, and no one can explain it, I'll be honest. You know, has the government taken the eye off the ball since they declared victory, you know, a couple of years ago? I mean, we literally, we have the video of, you know, President Buhari declaring victory, and yet this group is still around. So I think Nigerians are still wondering that question themselves, like, how can they not defeat them with all the resources and the help they supposedly receive internationally? But again, you know, the country has bigger problems to worry about, and we're demanding that the government deal with this Boko Haram scourge, which is not allowing the north of the country to truly progress.
U.S. pushing Israeli agenda in Africa.
Under pressure from the United States, two African countries, Sudan and Morocco, normalized ties with the Israeli regime in return for favors from Washington.
This pressure to normalize ties with the Israeli regime comes while the African Union has been a longtime supporter of the liberation of Palestine. But why is the Israeli regime hell-bent on establishing ties with African countries?
I think the battle is to legitimize the settler state, to legitimize the practice of anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab racism as a norm, and to normalize that the occupation of Palestine and the subjugation of its people is something that is central to that agenda. But to be able to get away with it, they need to have sufficient consensus internationally, at least to be seen to be complicit and in recognizing the illegal occupation.
Refugees and illegal migrants.
Thousands of African refugees and illegal migrants fleeing war, poverty, and persecution are dying, while others face harrowing abuse in their attempt to reach Europe's Mediterranean coasts.
Many risk their lives in this journey fraught with dangers. According to the International Organization for Migration, over 1,100, mostly African migrants, perished in the Mediterranean in 2020.
Bukangesa, an activist and commentator, says that Western countries are the root cause of this illegal migrant crisis.
The easier way to stop all this escalation of immigration going to Europe is let the United States and their Western allies stop raining us with bombs. Because now I look at the case of Libya, which is the most unfortunate case. After Obama sent the drones there and his friends in France, Gaddafi was murdered. Now we have anarchy there. We have, cells of terrorism there. But these people are fleeing war from their countries. These wars have not been caused by themselves, but they have been caused by, mostly imperialist wars that are taking place in the African continent.
Bukangeda there says that illegal immigrants are caused by Western imperialists in Africa.
U.S. dumping plastics in Africa.
In matters to do with the environment, over the last few months, there have been concerns that the United States plans to dump plastics in Africa, and particularly in Kenya. In April, the American Chemistry Council members, of which include Shell, Exxon Total, DuPont and Dow, proposed investments in recycling in Kenya, provided that the recipient country accepts U.S. plastic wastes. According to the plan, Kenya will get about 500 million tons of plastic waste exports from the U.S. per year. Greenpeace Africa voiced concern over the reports.
Plastics have been touted as major polluters of our water bodies, the rivers, the oceans, and this is something that Kenyans have rejected quite significantly, and we have a very strong law that prohibits single-use plastic. So this deal is very progressive, and we want to reject it.
While it remains to be seen if the U.S. will go ahead with its plan to dump plastics in Africa in 2021.
African startups.
Nigerian startups contributed more than 17% of the over $1 billion funds raised by African startups in 2020. This is according to the data gathered by Startup List Africa on the African startup ecosystem. The report revealed that the funds were raised by over 280 startups in more than 350 deals across the continent in 2020.
However, there are concerns of digital colonialism as foreigners come to exploit local tech experts. A victim explains here how his innovation was stolen by counterparts from an American university.
When my partners were completing their MBA at Stanford University, so having newly raised capital and having a product that was already in the market, the plan was for them to come to Kenya and then we'd set up shop and we'd together grow the company and move it forward. Apparently, as much as I thought that we were working together as a team.
Silencing guns in Africa. The 29th Summit of the African Union, held in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia in 2017, declared the month of September of each year until 2020 as Africa Amnesty Month for the surrender and collection of illicit small arms and light weapons. While still on the same subject, Iran Ambassador to Kenya, Dr. Jafar Barmeki, has called for proactive action among African countries to address emerging challenges, including internal strife. The ambassador spoke last December during the launch of the World Cartoon Festival on applying arts and culture in silencing the guns in Africa, a competition that invites works of art from cartoonists across the globe. The competition will run from December 2020 to May 2021. Ambassador Barmeki elaborates here on the festival.
Through this festival, the embassy, in line with the efforts of African Union, will accelerate the two calls to action by assimilating both 2020 and 2021 themes, which will enable a promotion of African arts, culture, and heritage while fast-tracking on silencing the guns initiative.
Well, that's all we had on some of the news that made headlines in Africa in 2020. Well, the last 12 months have been as intense and breathless for Africa. We look forward to recovery and a prosperous 2021, where Africa will take its rightful place among the nations of the world. It's been great having you with us today. And on behalf of the entire Africa Today team, it's goodbye from me and have a fruitful year ahead.
Over the past few years, the United Arab Emirates has been pursuing a plethora of agendas in southern Yemen, whether directly or via backing the separate Southern Transitional Council, SDC. Among Abu Dhabi's primary objectives in Yemen are taking control of the country's western coasts in the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb, a strait located between Yemen, Djibouti, and Eritrea in the Horn of Africa, and Socotra, an archipelago near major shipping routes. But this hegemonic ambition has never been in the shape of taking strategic locations alone. The story of Balhaf is a case in point, a major oil facility in Shabwa Governorate, turned by the Emiratis into a detention center, among other things. The existence of the Balhaf prison was first announced by the United Nations in September 2019. 2 months later, Armaments Observatory released a detailed report about the facility, which the Emiratis had turned into a military base and a secret prison.
The fact that they've taken over a gas plant essential for the country's energy supply and for its economy and turned it into a detention camp where torture is being reportedly carried on is an indication of just the brutality of this occupation force in Yemen.
Based on witness accounts, the report also accused Emirati soldiers of treating prisoners inhumanely. The UAE had already been accused of running a secret network of prisons across Yemen.
But I think having prisons in other countries, particularly in Yemen, it's difficult to tell what's happening in Yemen because there's a war. So, I mean, it's much easier to hide political prisoners, torture. It's more difficult for human rights agencies to tell what exactly is happening, and it's much easier for the authorities and the occupation forces to deny that these abuses are taking place. So I think having a detention center in Yemen is advantageous for the United Arab Emirates in that sense. Remember that the United Arab Emirates is a country that presents its image of itself as a modernizing country. It's highly invested in technology, and Dubai is a major city in the world, a major modern city, so it would not work to have this kind of brutality on its own shores.
But what made the story strange was the awkward silence of France since the revelation. Given that Total SE, a French multinational oil and gas company, was the biggest shareholder with nearly 40% of stakes, critics said the silence was significant. Recently, the French Parliament has called on Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian to answer questions about the alleged existence of a UAE-built military base and detention center in the vicinity of Balhaf. French lawmaker Clémentine Autain has accused Emmanuel Macron's government of covering up crimes committed by the UAE at Balhaf. The fact is, the UAE has gradually become a crucial partner for France. In the words of French historian Sébastien Nadot, despite their small size and low profile, the Emiratis play a key role in France's international strategy. A rich federation with a big appetite for arms purchase, the UAE is worth enough for the French to look the other way when the Emiratis are violating human rights at Balhaf or anywhere else. In fact, France's silence could be explained by its lucrative partnership with Abu Dhabi, especially in military cooperation and arms trade.
United Arab Emirates, of course, have been relying on French technology. They have the tanks, Leclerc tanks, and Mirage planes, which they've been supplied with by the French. The French continue to maintain those military technologies that they're using, that equipment that they're using. And of course, that is a key to their to the war, because the equipment, most of it, is being bought in the West, in particularly in France. And so the French are heavily involved in this whole scenario here, where essentially the country's energy supply is now, this major energy plant is now being used as a torture and a prison center.
Despite public outrage, arms deals have been getting bigger over the past decade between Paris and Abu Dhabi, according to the 2020 report to Parliament on arms exports. The first French multi-service military base in the Middle East is located in Abu Dhabi, housing around 700 military personnel. The base includes an air base, a naval base capable of receiving a French aircraft carrier, and an army base.
Well, since 2010, under Nicolas Sarkozy, President Sarkozy, the French have upped their investment in Arab countries, in particular the United Arab Emirates. They even have a military base in the United Arab Emirates, so they have been very much involved in supplying and modernizing the United Arab Emirates their military technology. And so that is the main reason. I mean, that partnership is quite extensive and quite deep. They've even allowed the United Arab Emirates to have major exports. Paintings, for example, have been exported temporarily to United Arab Emirates in exchange for continued military contracts. So these military contracts are extremely important for France. I already mentioned Mirage planes, Leclerc tanks, and many more, much more technology. This is a multi-billion dollar industry.
According to Emma Sobriere, for France, a presence in the UAE is strategic and will allow easy intervention to prevent possible disturbances affecting access to Gulf oil. Abu Dhabi is visibly formulating a regional strategy of influence with a focus on the creation of commercial and military port facilities stretching from the Horn of Africa to the Mediterranean. Given the military background of Emirati Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, the French have little, if any, doubt that the UAE will continue signing big arms deals with them. According to Jalal Harchawi of Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, in general, Paris does not want to strike any false note that might spoil its intimate friendship with Abu Dhabi, believing that this symbiotic relationship will, in the years to come, always lead to success.
The idea that France supports human rights and that it has concern for human rights is really a myth. The human rights discourse is really part of the foreign policy agenda of the French. It's about presenting a positive image of France as a moral order, as a moral power, when in reality, they have never been interested in human rights. The main interest is in power projection, and economic exchange and exploitation, in particular, of developing countries. And the Gulf states allied with Israel and the West are key to that agenda.
Located on the Gulf of Aden coast in the southern part of Yemen, Belhaf mirrors the inhumanity of the Emiratis, who have turned Yemen's major source of income into a secret, macabre prison, and the greed of the French, who seem to have preferred petrodollars to anything else in the world.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.